You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Hello, hello, fine people of the interwebs. I am live right now, adjusting my camera, So a little thing for you all watching this live video. Hi, Rosemary. That's my boyfriend's mom. I have a wonderful quote behind me, but we're doing a Facebook Live tonight, which we will rip the audio and video for the podcast. But there's a quote behind me. Now, it is backwards on Facebook. And so if you can read that, that means you have super woke intellectual abilities. Hi. Hello, lovely people. So I have a really awesome guest tonight, but while I am waiting for him to request join, I'm going to just plug a few things that I'm doing right now. Obviously, this is airing live on Facebook, but it's going to go to some other platforms, which I'm really excited about. I have joined one of the coolest podcast networks out there, one of the top five libertarian podcast networks. And, oh, there's Murray. I'm going to add Murray real quick because he's my guest. I'm approving you, Murray. So I have a show on the We Are Libertarians podcast network, which is fairly new. And it's an awesome network. It's called Gingerarchy. Hi, Murray. You can adjust all you need to. This is very informal. So you can follow me at Gingerarchy, Facebook, Trisha Stewart, Facebook, Instagram, Trisha.Stewart, Twitter, Trisha Arkey. So it's T-R-I-C-I-A-R-C-H-Y. Can you find me all on all those social media accounts? But if, hi, Murray. You're a little, the video is a little corrupted. Okay, that's better. And so the video will show up on We Are Libertarians Network. It's a cool podcast network. And I want to give a shout out to a lot of the cool shows there. I am their token anarchist and their token ginger. So I am not quite half as fancy as the people on that show. But you should definitely go there if you're looking for a podcast to follow or some new information. They're definitely somebody that you want to follow. So go to We Are Libertarians podcast network or WeLibertarians.com or go on Facebook. You can just type it in and you'll find it. Hello, Dr. Murray Sabrin. Am I saying it correctly? Oh, wonderful. I am absolutely so glad that you have joined me this evening. Thank you and welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's the first interview since my book was published
and posted awesome on Facebook. We're going to get to your book
Amazon the other day.
Probably the largest part of our discussion. But first, I would like to let people know who my guest is. And I am certainly outclassed by him. And I'm really excited to have him on. This is Dr. Murray Sabrin. He hails from New Jersey. Can you say Jersey in a Jersey accent? Jersey. Yes. Very nice.
Jersey.
So I would describe you as a professor, an activist, a historian, an economist, and one of the most badass original gangster libertarians that there are around. Would you agree with that? I did. Oh, wonderful.
Well,
like
I think
said,
you nailed
I do
it.
An informal show. I do social media, and I am not a historian. I'm an activist, though, so we have that. We can cross over there. We're going to promote your new book. What is the title of your new book?
Why the Federal Reserve Sucks. It causes inflation, recessions, bubbles, and enriches the 1%. And there should be another subtitle, which
we'll get to that. Adding that onto the show outline, for sure. So, Murray, something I like to do is I like to get personal. So I love liberty. I'm a fan of praxeology, human action, but I like to get to know the people behind liberty. So something I find is interesting, you were born in Germany and your parents were Holocaust survivors. So Murray was born in 1949, am I correct?
No, that's when we came to America. Next month
Holy
is
cow.
My 70th
okay.
anniversary
so how
coming
old were
to
you
America.
When you came here? What's your liberty story? Just give us a background on that.
I was 2.5 years old. My parents were the only ones in their family to survive World War II. My father, there's a picture of him right in front of me. Some of it is in the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. He led 240 partisans. He was a commander in Poland. And for a year, he was fighting the Nazis till they were liberated by the Russians in July 1944. And my mother and he and my older brother, who was born during the war, we came to America. First of all, my mother and father and young older brother came to West Germany in 1946 when my mother was pregnant with me. And we stayed there for 2.5 years. And we came to America because my father's great aunt lived in America, who raised his mother in America. And then she went back to Poland. And my father's first cousin came to America, I think in 1946, 47. So they sponsored us to America. That's why I'm a firm believer. If people want to come to America, do what we did. Get sponsors so you're not a burden on the American people. And I think that would solve a lot of the immigration problems that we're facing today. Instead of having hordes of people coming across the border, I think if we have an orderly procession of people who are sponsored like we were, and there's an organization called HIAS that has been around for 150 years helping refugees all over the world. They helped us, according to my father's story, when I was old enough to ask, how did we get to America? And so learning as a youngster what they had to go through to survive World War II, and as I became a history major as an undergraduate and started learning about finance and economics and libertarianism in the late 60s, early 70s, I said, not only is big government evil when it goes to its extreme, but what we have today, the welfare warfare state, is bad because it takes people's money away through taxation. It regulates them through the regulatory state. We have undeclared wars since the end of World War II, which are not obviously in our interest. And so we have this welfare warfare state, the term that Murray Rothbard coined, that I think just sums up the problem we're facing in America. Now, that's the bad side. The good side is, and this is something as a finance professor, I've really appreciated over the last 34 years teaching finance. American entrepreneurs are incredibly productive, creative, innovative, and that's why our standard of living is as high as it is, and we're not Venezuela, or we're not Greece, or we're not some of the other Western countries that have had big governments. So we have enough free enterprise in America so we can enjoy the fruits of all the great innovations that have taken place, such as the phone that I'm speaking to you on, the iPhone, which is an incredible invention when you think about it. We can call people around the world for free. When years ago that would cost an arm and a leg, and only w rich people and corporations would do that. But now we can video chat anywhere in the world, which is an amazing phenomenon. And we have more computing power than the computers that 50 years ago sent the men to the moon. So I believe that we are in a glass half full and half empty. The half full is all the great productivity and entrepreneurship that's in America. The half empty is this incredible size of the welfare warfare state that is really undermining our prosperity and our freedoms. And that's why I've dedicated myself to writing about this. That's why I wrote this book on the Fed. I'm currently writing a book on healthcare, which is going to be a big issue in the political, in the presidential campaign next year. And then next year, I want to write a book on on war and peace, but that title has already been
No.
taken. So I have to come up with another title. No, this is important because there are still people in Washington who think that we have to rule the world. And this is, I think, one of the Achilles heel of the country, is that there are people who believe that it's our destiny, just as we settle the West, we have to now make sure we have world order through American troops all over the world. We have troops in 900 countries. We have bases
Yeah, we're in
all over the
40%.
world. We
We're in
have
40% of the
monies
nations
going
in
all
the
over the
world right
world.
now.
We're spending it's amazing. When we were in Australia several years ago, and driving on the tour bus, the tour guide said, "Look over in the distance. You see that building there? That's an Amer secret American outpost." So they have listening po our government has listening posts all over the world, as if somebody's ready to invade us. I mean, no one can invade us. No one has invaded us. And so this whole notion that we have to have a military that's bigger than the te 10 next military in the world is just outlandish. That was World War II was supposed to give us peace forever, and it certainly hasn't happened that way. That was the war to end Nazism and Japanese aggression. And what we've done is built up this huge military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about in his 61 farewell address. So I believe that liberty is the natural right, if you will, of human beings. It's the way we have international peace, we have commerce, we have social justice, if you will, to use a term that has been appropriated. Because individual rights is, as the Declaration says, is guaranteed to us by our Creator, if you believe that. If not, it's basically the way to have a civilized society. And of course, it's described in the Bill of Rights. It's the Bill of rights that we have as individual citizens that the government is supposed to protect. Unfortunately, the government has trampled on all our rights, from the First Amendment to the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment. And so that's what's upsets
Oh, I would
people
agree.
around the country. That's why Trump won, by the way. He tapped into the angst of people in the quote, so-called flyover country, who were felt this engaged from the government, and the government has been telling them how to live their lives and doing trade deals which have not been in their best interest, and essentially hollowing out the American economy. And so we're dependent upon nations around the world for basic manufactured goods when a lot of them could be produced. I'm not a protectionist by any means. All I'm saying is our monetary policy has created so many dollars. Those dollars have gone overseas. That's built up the economies of China and South Korea and other countries. And so basically our biggest export has been dollars, not goods that would give us a trade surplus. Not that a
I
trade
think that's an
surplus
interesting
is that
point.
important,
So,
but go ahead.
obviously, I believe that you are a minarchist. You believe in some legitimate form of government. Is that true?
Well, so little that it wouldn't matter who's the president of the United States. They could go and do ribbon cuttings. The same thing with governors and mayors. The point is, theoretically, I think we could have a society without a formal government. Just as Bruce Benson pointed out in his great book, I think it's called the some where he pointed out that throughout history, we've had
Oh,
society and law, the
I'm not
enterprise of law,
familiar.
that's what it's called. Bruce Benson, The Economist, The Enterprise of Law. It's a phenomenal book. I think it was published in the early 90s. He pointed out that there have been societies where you haven't had formal governments, but you've had law because people in their culture accepted the tribal elders or the wise people of society that would issue laws or rules or guidelines that people accepted because it was in everyone's self-interest to have a peaceful society. It's very expensive to be a crook because not only do you need armaments, but you may get killed and very quickly. So the point is, he points out in Enterprise of Law, there have been societies throughout Europe, throughout South America, throughout Asia, that you haven't had formal governments. So I think we came very, very close to that in the colonial period. Governments were very small. And even when the Republic was formed, we didn't have much of a government, a central government,
Oh,
except that
screw that
Hamilton
guy.
was pushing for that early on in our history.
Oh,
And I mean, Hamilton
I
is
would
one of
agree.
he should be taken off the $10 bill and Harriet Tubman put on there. I mean, he is, as Tom DiLorenzo pointed out,
Truly, I think
the
that's a
father
wonderful
of
term, and I
crony
had not heard that
capitalism.
before. So, I'm already going off of my outline, which I told you I'm an informal host. I'm not a fancy pants, but you tied the dollar to world currency and being unsafe because of how the dollar doesn't really hold any true value. And I think it's a really cool way to tie the dollar to war. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, you really have to go back to World War I. World War I, I think, was one of those important events in human history because if you look at World War I, all the countries went off the gold standard so they can print up money to pay for the war. And then when we went back to the gold standard, Britain messed it up badly, and their economy was sort of depressed throughout the 1920s. And our Federal Reserve helped bail them out by printing up dollars, which gave us the real estate and stock market boom. And we know how that ended. It ended in the crash, the Great Depression, and then the trade wars of the 1930s. So World War I was a defining moment. Germany had hyperinflation after World War I. Russia had hyperinflation. A lot of countries had hyperinflation. So they understood that printing up money will lead to disasters. And so war and printing money go hand in hand. You cannot have big government and war without the printing press. And that's what governments do quite well. They print up a lot of money and destroy the currency. Now, our currency has been in a slow free fall for 100 years since the Federal Reserve was created. But now we're seeing the end of this experiment, the Bretton Woods system. By the way, this month is the 75th anniversary of the Bretton Woods system that gave us the post-war monetary system that Nixon helped close down in 1971 when he severed
Let
the
me
last
interrupt
link
you,
of
and not
dollar
because
and gold in 1971.
I have anything intellectual to say, but because I would say that so a lot of my followers on Facebook might not be anarchists or libertarians, and so they probably have no background in what you're talking about. Can you give a little overview of the Federal Reserve, how it came to being, and then where we are now?
Sure. Yeah, this is a fascinating history. So if you're a history major, American history major, an economic historian, a financial historian, the creation of the Federal Reserve is essentially the dream of Hamilton going back 100 years earlier, and those folks who wanted central banking. They attempted three times to have a central bank in the United States, and they all failed. And then we had a panic of 1907, the one that J.P. Morgan bailed out the federal government. That led to a secret meeting in Jekyll Island over in Georgia.
That. Because I don't think most people, and I apologize for interrupting, but I know that people are probably as not as well educated as you on here. And so Jekyll Island has been a bit of a conspiracy theory for a while, but it's actually open source information. So tell people a little bit more in depth about that.
Absolutely. Well, what happened is representatives of the Morgan banking interests, the Rockefellers, Kuhn Loeb, the big Wall Street banks, some people from Congress, Senator Aldrich from Rhode Island, who was married to one of the Rockefellers. And they got together and basically ironed out the blueprint for the Federal Reserve. And there's a great video from the Mises Institute by Professor Rothbard, who talks about the founding of the Federal Reserve. It's an hour long. I urge everyone to view it. I show it in my financial history class, the founding of the Federal Reserve. It was the last piece of the progressive period which cartelized the most important sector of the economy, banking, because the bankers operate under a very flawed system. It's called fractional reserves, where they borrow short and lend long. If anyone saw the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, where there's a bank run at the end of the movie, people are trying to get their money out of the Bailey savings and loans. This is an example of the flawed system. So the bankers realized they could not continue to have fractional reserve banking unless they had a lender of last resort. That's what's one of the reasons for the Federal Reserve being created, to have an institution that would buy the assets of banks and provide them with liquidity if they ran into trouble. So in 1910, they got together, and you can read this on the Federal Reserve's website of the creation of the Federal Reserve, and they got together, and they had to sell this to the American people as an anti-bank bill, but it was really a pro-banking bill because the bankers needed a federal government backstop to prevent more bank runs, because throughout the 19th century, we had banking panics. The Panic of 1819, which was written by Professor Rothbard, that was his doctoral dissertation in the 1950s, explaining how the money printing from the War of 1812 onward led to the banking panic of 1819. Then we had the panic of 1837, 1850. It goes on and on and on. In other words, the banks are terribly flawed institutions. And eventually we got a central bank. We were the last major industrialized nation to get a central bank. The first central bank was the Bank of England in the 1690s. And so we got the central bank that was basically the heaven sent for the bankers, because now they could have an institution that would back them up if things went wrong. We saw what happened during the financial crisis of 2008. The Federal Reserve stepped in and bought up trillions of dollars of assets to prop up Wall Street and the banking sector. So we got the Federal Reserve in 1913. It started operating in 1914, and it started printing money when World War I began, and we entered the war in 1917. And that gave us a correction after the war, what's called the Forgotten Depression, a book titled by Jim Grant, who's a longtime financial analyst, still writes for Barron's again, who pointed out that we had a very deep depression after World War I. It was a correction for all the money printing that we took place, just like we've had the last 10 years. And then we had the Roaring Twenties. But We had the wrong 20s because of great productivity, a lot of innovation in the 1920s, but we also had a lot of money printing, which gave us this huge stock market bubble that ended in October 1929. And then Hoover was president, and he did everything wrong, intervening, trying to prop up prices as the banks were collapsing and money was being credit was being liquidated, so the money supply was falling. And so prices had to fall also. So instead of prices falling and wages falling, we got 25% unemployment by 1932, and he was utterly defeated at the polls in 1932 by FDR, who ran on a very fiscal conservative
Very
platform, by the
ironic,
way.
right?
He said we've got to
Ironic
restore the
of what
gold
he did.
standard, we've got to have a balanced budget. It is inc well, this is why when you learn this, you realize every president, every candidate that wins the presidency goes back typically on what they campaigned on. Johnson in 64, no boys are going to go to Vietnam. Wilson in 1916, no boys, we're not going to go to Europe to fight the war. And a month after he was inaugurated in 1917, we're in World War I. FDR in 1940, when war was raging in Europe, he said American boys are not going to Europe to fight the wars in Europe. And Johnson in 64 said American boys are not going to Vietnam.
Yes.
And of course, Bush said we have to humble foreign policy in 2000 when he ran for president. And of course, 3 years later, we're
Right.
invading Iraq, a country that was no threat to us at all. And so, in order to do all this stuff, the government needs money. So they don't raise taxes to pay for it because that would be an outcry by the public. So they print up money. They literally buy up assets from the banks, usually government securities, and that injects money into the system, which allows the federal government to borrow all this money. And we're off to the races. And so we've seen this over and over again since the Federal Reserve was been created, that the printing of money and the warfare welfare state
Yes.
or the welfare warfare state go hand in hand. You cannot have a welfare warfare state unless you have a central bank that's ready to prop up the economy and the federal government. And by the way, what the most insidious thing that the Federal Reserve has done is depress interest rates so the federial government has borrowed at least $10 trillion
And
over the last 10
who will
years
be the
at
victim
very
of the
low interest
first?
rates,
Not the
which means
government,
that
the people.
well, it's going to be, well, no, of course not. It's going to be the average person who may get laid off or lose their house or whatever the case may be, like we saw in 2008 and 2009. It's Main Street that gets hurt by all this money printing. Now we have a boom, so unemployment looks pretty good now, under 4% or thereabouts, which historically is very low. But I think that is a number that is fallacious because a lot of
Right.
people are no longer looking for work, and some
Well,
people have
unemployment
two
numbers by the
jobs,
government
some
are
people
very
have part-time
convoluted,
jobs only.
because, if somebody's not looking for work anymore, they're still employed. I mean, that's common sense, but the
Yeah.
government has no common sense, so.
Well, the thing is, I don't trust government numbers because the thing is with the Consumer Price Index, it's been at this roughly 2% area for several years now. Now, that's very unusual for an index like that to be flatlined, if you will, for many, many years. So, one thing I noticed, and they're supposed to take this into account, and we've been told this when we bought appliances a few years
Oh, they
ago,
have.
the
Yeah.
quality of the appliances have really come down. So, instead of a refrigerator, let And instead of a refrigerator lasting 15 years or more, they tell us you're lucky if you get 10 years out of a new refrigerator these days. So you're paying a lot more money for an item that's giving you a lot less value. And that's supposed to be reflected in the CPI. I don't think it is. And the thing is, everything is thrown into the CPI. So I want to write an article that says that the CPI gives us a false sense of what is happening to prices. Because we know
Sure.
taxes go up every year. Property taxes go up every year. We pay more Social Security taxes every year as your salary goes up. But we don't buy a house every year. We don't buy a computer every year. We don't buy a car every year. So what I'm going to propose is that we have an index that talks about consumer capital goods that last a long time, and see how those prices are doing, and then have a separate thing for services, which the government does now, separate thing for things that food and gasoline that we buy on a weekly, daily, monthly basis. So we need to have a consumer price
You're working
index.
on a book on that
Healthcare
right
is a
now,
big
aren't you?
item, obviously, in a lot of people's budgets. It's amazing what you come up with healthcare. In fact, what we're seeing today, Tricia, is President Truman's vision from 1945 of having a single-payer system. He proposed this in 1945, and then President Johnson got the ball rolling with Medicare and Medicaid in 1965.
Yeah, the Medicare Act.
Then President Bush with prescription drugs, and then President Obama, President Obama with Obamacare. And so the next logical step in this progression from a vision in 1945, which is what, 74 years ago, to single-payer system maybe in 10, 20 years.
Oh, it's
That's
inevitable.
Where we're headed. That's the road that we've been traveling on. And so, and the thing, that's why I'm writing this book, to point out that there's a really big difference in what we need to do between a government healthcare system, a single-payer system, and a free market doctor-patient relationship that would make sure that everyone is covered. That's the goal that I have in this book, to point out how everyone can get medical care without having big government, without, in fact, even government involved at all.
How do you inform people of that? How do you get that out to the mass public? Because I don't think that the American people are liberty-minded or even understand free markets anymore. There's probably like 1% of us, which are libertarians, that do. Because obviously Democrats and Republicans have no idea what a free market is, or even economics, like basic, regardless of if they're Chicago or Keynesian or, Austrian, they have no idea. So how do you get that message out there?
Well, this is the challenge. That's why I either write a book. I mean, I wrote an op-ed recently for the local paper. Maybe 200,000 people read it, either online or the hard copy. So, and the editor likes the stuff that I write, even though he's a left-winger. So he says, you write really well. So that's a compliment from an editor who said that you really write well, and he didn't change anything. And he puts my letters in quite frequently. and so when I write a letter, it's usually the maximum 250 words. So a lot of people see that. And this is how we get the message out. And so I have a provocative title for my book on the Fed, because, as you know, the left has been very successful in getting publicity. Look at the four freshmen congresswomen who are getting this incredible publicity. You couldn't buy the publicity.
Yeah, social media.
You can't buy the publicity that.
Yeah.
Well, this is it. If we could reach 100,000, 200,000, 500,000 people, and we can get my book sales to a high ranking on Amazon and possibly get on the New York Times bestseller list, then the media will have to engage me in saying, do we need a Federal Reserve given all the bad things that it does? It creates inflation, recessions, bubbles, and enriches the 1%. So what social good, economic good, is the Federal Reserve? And I have answers for all their objections to why we need a Federal Reserve. And so that's what I want to do, is go out there and challenge the conventional thinking on money, on credit, on banking, and really show the American people, this is just common sense. I mean, if you had an unlimited checking account, which is what the Federal Reserve does, think about this. It has an unlimited checking account. When I first learned about this 50 years ago, I said, my goodness, what are the consequences of that? And then when I started researching my dissertation in the 1970s about inflation, I said the key to the dollar, remember we had double-digit inflation in 73, 74, then again in 79. And I said the key to the U.S. dollar remaining the world's reserve currency is the trust that foreigners have in holding dollars and buying our treasuries. Now, that may be over in the not-too-distant future, because we are reading reports that both China and Russia are buying gold for their central bank.
If I can interject,
real
that's really
reserves
scary,
instead of the U.S. dollar
because of
in reserves.
The state that the United States is in around the globe, we are involved in a lot of proxy wars, and we hold weight. And I'm just going to say this in a very basic, generic term for the people that are following that might not be libertarians or whatever. And so, our dollar falling has a lot of repercussions as far as like the countries that might not go to war with us or may back us or want our money. The dollar has a lot to do with the war state. And I know we touched on that earlier, but it's a really scary proposition for the dollar to fall.
Well, this is it. When the dollar declines, prices go up for foreign goods, and that will will filter through the consumer price index and give us higher inflation as measured by the consumer price index. But it looks like inflation is going to accelerate because of all these trade wars. We're getting less goods coming into the country, and therefore there's less supply of goods. There's a lot of money in the system, and that's one of
I'm
the
sure you're
definitions of
familiar with
inflation: too
Smelly
much money
Butler.
chasing too few goods.
I think it's one of his quotes, and I could
Oh,
be
yeah, absolutely.
misattributing it, so I apologize because I'm, as I said, I'm not fancy, but it was something about when goods and services do not cross borders, soldiers will. Was that?
Well, I think
Oh, it's Basquiat. It
that
was
may
a
have been
Basquiat
attributed
quote,
to
which I love him.
Frederick
He's
Bastiat.
like Shakespeare for minarchism or anarchism. But yeah, and it's very true though. I've read it several times.
His book, The Law, had such a profound
Did
impact.
you?
I first read that in 1974. It was part of my libertarian education back in the 1970s, and I picked it up. And to me, it is probably one of the most important books of Western civilization because he was writing this to oppose the communism and socialism of Europe in the mid-19th century. And
And
it
it's not
rings true
even, it's
today as
very
it did
poetic. I
150
love his
years ago.
writing. You can tell that he's a writer and not necessarily a philosopher or a politician. So his writing translates to a lot of people because it touches them on the heart. And I would quite agree. I feel bad that I misattributed. I love Smedley Butler. But yeah, Bastiat, he's bae. But it's very ironic because a lot of people disassociate economics and the war state and social justice and government, and they're all so much intertwined. If you study human action, they're the same thing.
Yep.
And so you're an Austrian economic person. You're a fan of Mises, Ludwig von Mises. You
Unfortunately, I never
did
had the
meet
opportunity to meet
Rothbard,
him, but
so
M
you
Murray
rubbed
Rothbard was a
shoulders with
member
him.
of my
Tell
dissertation.
us about that, because
He
that's
was a member of my
freaking
dissertation
amazing. So
committee.
tell us
Yeah,
about
yeah.
your
He,
experiences with Rothbard.
well, well, the first exposure I had to Murray Rothbard's writings was 36,000 feet above the Atlantic Ocean, flying home from Italy in 1971 after President Nixon imposed wage price controls. And someone was reading the New York Times in early September 1971, and I saw the op-ed article, "The President's Economic Betrayal." And I asked the gentleman who was reading it, I said, "Can I have it after you're done?" And he said, "Sure." So I read it. And this was the most lucid, clear discussion of President Nixon's wage price controls. Now, I had been familiar with some free market economics, reading Milton Friedman in Newsweek magazine and Alan Greenspan and Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, about the importance of having a gold-backed monetary system. But Rothbard really laid it out. I think it's one of the most brilliant essays during that period about wage price controls and economic freedom. And then I just sort of put it aside. And when I went to graduate school in the early 70s and I developed a dissertation topic, I invited him to be a member of my dissertation committee, which he said yes. And he got me an invitation to the
How
first
cool did
Austrian
you feel?
Economic Conference in
How cool
South
did you
Burlington,
feel?
Vermont in 1974. Oh, that was very special because I was just learning this material. And I roomed with Joe Salerno, the great Austrian economist from Pace University and the Mises Institute. And he got his PhD about the same time I did at Rutgers. He was in the economics department. I was in the geography department, but my PhD was on economic geography, studying inflation and how it affects local economies. And I just immersed myself in Rothbard's writings, Mises' writings, Hayek's writings, and just really became not only a fan, but someone who wanted to write in this tradition on contemporary issues, applying the principles of human
Yes.
action, because it's so simple. Everyone wants to achieve their goals, short-term, intermediate, and long-term goals. And if you do it peacefully, you're a libertarian.
Oh,
If you don't do it
I'm going to
peacefully,
like steal
you're an
that quote and post it all over social
authoritarian.
media. That is such a great point. Like, these are natural human actions. And if you do it peacefully, then you are a libertarian. Like, that's a really, really great statement.
That's it. Well, I sometimes I come up with these things spontaneously, but the point is, I've been reading this stuff for more than 50 years now. Since, actually, 50 years ago, I first read Alan Greenspan's Golden Economic Freedom, and I discussed that in my book on the Federal Reserve that just came out as sort of the basis for his turning around and becoming the head of the institution that he vociferously criticized in that essay of the Fed giving us the bubble of the 1920s, and then he's in charge of the Fed giving us the bubble of the dot-com bubble and then the housing bubble. It's so ironic that he was a great critic of the Fed when he was a private citizen, and then he becomes part of the swamp, if you will, in Washington, D.C., as head of the Federal
Well,
Reserve.
no, and
So,
that's
as they say, you
ironic that
can't
you said
make
it
this
because
stuff up.
honestly, I'm gonna be 100% honest with you. As a former neocon, I've always looked at Greenspan as having really convoluted economic ideas. I did not understand that at one point he was had a different ideology, which just goes to show that power creates more power and corruption.
Oh boy, let me tell you, yeah, that's about the beltway. It's people go to Washington, they drink the water, and they really become a defender of the crown, if you will, the crown being the federal government. And it's leading us to a very bad place. That's my biggest fear. Hopefully Trump has enough common sense,
But
given
he's
that he
not,
criticized the Iraq
he
war
just,
during the
can I,
campaign.
I'm sorry
He
to
will
interrupt
not
because you're
be
so much more brilliant
he
than I am, but I'm going way off script here, but I'm really enjoying this conversation and it's my show. So he just vetoed a bill to disarm the Saudis. I'm sure you probably, as a libertarian, understand that the worst thing in the world that's happening right now is the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. So we are arming the, oh, no.
Yeah,
That's
and it's nowhere on the
amazing to
news,
me.
nowhere on the
And
news.
that's been one of my biggest why I want to get my voice out there. I've raised a lot of money for Save the Children slash Yemen, and I just can't understand why people don't see this. So he had, as an executive with unconstitutional authority, because pretty much the president can do what he wants nowadays. The Constitution is just so long gone. But all he would have to say to the Saudis is, and I'm sorry, Murray, because you're a fancy guy, but I swear on my show, all he would have to say is "fuck you." You get nothing. But he doesn't do that because what happens to the executive once he gets in office, regardless of what Trump said before, he has voices in his ear, and these are the neocons, and these are this is swamp, and so. For him to say, we're not going to arm you to the Saudis, or we're not going to back your support, we're not going to refuel your ships or your airplanes, that would go against the status quo. And he won't do that because every president, regardless of how you think that he's different, and you think maybe Trump is different, he's not. He bows to the same masters. And that, it, yeah, it's the state.
Well, his first Yeah, his first trip overseas, I think, was to Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's a telling event that why would he go to Saudi Arabia his first overseas trip? And as you
It's the
point
worst
out,
thing
the
that's
Yemen
happening in the
crisis
world
is
right
just
now, and we will
unbelievable. I mean,
reach Holocaust numbers. I don't think people understand that. So 250,000 civilian deaths right now. They're literally bombing flocks of sheep to starve these people. I don't think people realize that. When this ends, even if it ends today, the fallout from it will be close to 1 million. It's a Holocaust.
well, you have cholera and typhus and all these horrible diseases going on, that the infrastructure is
It
being
is.
destroyed. It's one of the poorest places on the planet. I mean, it's like we bombing Haiti. I mean, what would
Exactly.
happen
It's
if
the
we bombed Haiti?
poorest
It would be a total
Middle
nightmare.
Eastern country out there. Like, they don't have many resources.
And it's probably one of the poorest countries in the world, if not the poorest country in the world. There's just nothing there. It just shows you where the Democrats and the Republicans in Washington's heads are at when they're talking about this nonsense of this of Russiagate and Russian meddling, when you have this incredible human disaster that years ago the Democrats would be jumping up and
Oh,
down
and they're
because
not.
they consider themselves such great humanitarians. Now they don't. They
There's a
probably
very
can't even
few,
find
like
Yemen on a
Upper
map, I
Pink,
bet you.
maybe. But most Democrats are, there's such partisanship in this country, partisan politics, that literally kids are crapping themselves to death across the globe, and the US is complicit, and they don't care because the orange man in the office says something bad. Like, what does that say about our country right now?
Well, I've been around a long time now. I've been in America now 70 years next month, and we've seen a devaluation, not only of our money, but our culture, our values. Everything is partisanship in Washington, D.C. The roads are in terrible shape. You saw the incident in New York City where they were throwing water on the police. It shows you a breakdown of just a civil society. Where this ends could be either major authoritarianism, where governments really
No,
crack
I
down,
believe
you have
that
curfews
is
and all
actually
that.
the
Hopefully,
road
we won't
leading to
get
the
there.
police state. And the worship of police state and the way that we're policing society and taking like national law and federal law and applying it to localities, it's very scary to me. And I.
Well, this is what you have. This is what you have when you have this monetary instability that causes the economy to go through these cycles. And the question is, when does the next cycle downturn occur? And I'm looking at several indicators that I looked at. And one of the key indicators that sort of foretells that the economy is ready to roll over is when the unemployment rate starts creeping up. And if you look at every economic downturn, the unemployment rate starts creeping up. And if it should happen next year, that's why Trump wants low
Well,
interest
he's
rates.
trying to get
That's why he's
reelected.
badgering the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low. Yeah, well, that's the hope. This is what Nixon did in 71 and 72 when Arthur Burns was at the Fed. So Trump is playing the same game that presidents have always played. Johnson did this in 67 when he got the Federal Reserve chairman down at his Texas ranch and said, you got to keep interest rates low to fund the Vietnam War and the Great Society programs. So this is nothing new, but Trump is playing a very, I think, politically a dangerous game by tying his presidency to the stock market. Because if the stock market starts tumbling next year, or if not, or this year, who knows? I mean, this October is the 90th anniversary of the stock market crash of 1929, and stranger things have happened when you
That
have these
let me
major
interrupt you
anniversaries
there,
going
Marie.
on.
So the
Go ahead.
stock market, a lot of people tie it to government, and I think that they're actually not associated as well as people think. So how does the government affect the stock market?
Well, the government, not so much per se, but it's really the Federal Reserve. That's why my book really points this out very nicely, is the stock market is really dependent upon liquidity, because what drives prices high? Liquidity. What determines liquidity in the system? The Federal Reserve by its printing of money or the creation of money through the banking system. And I describe that in the book. So it's really a good introduction to people who want a little history about money and banking in the United States, what money ha should be, has been. And how the Federal Reserve during the Greenspan and Bernanke eras gave us these two bubbles, the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble, and how the Austrians were right about all this stuff. Now, there were some mainstream economists that got it right also, but for the wrong reasons, I think. But the Austrians got it right because of their focus on the Federal Reserve and credit and interest rates and all that stuff, which is what the driving force is for the stock market, for the bond market, for the currency markets. And so that's why there are a lot of Fed watchers out there who watch what the Federal Reserve policy is. And right now, the Federal Reserve is trying to manage the economy, which they can't do successfully over the long term. They can do it over the short term. And Bernanke said in his testimony, which is in the record that I quoted, he said the Federal Reserve manipulates interest rates. Now, that was
He's
a
saying
shocking
it's a false
revelation that he
market.
would say that because corporate, yeah, if a corporate executive said we manipulate prices of our goods, they would be hauled before Congress and probably be arrested for manipulation. And so this is another example of why the Federal Reserve is an an antithesis to
Can I
sustainable
interject?
prosperity. We
And
do
you
have
are much
prosperity, but
more
it's not
intelligent than
because
I,
of the
but
Federal Reserve.
it's basically
Sure.
a not a free market principle. And as an anarchist, anybody that goes against free market economics is
Yeah.
false. And so it's a false market, and that's why it fails. It's a monopoly on force,
Yeah.
which is not natural and not free market. Obviously, it's going to fail,
Yeah.
and it oppresses people, and it doesn't lend people to free market associations. And I don't think a lot of people understand free markets, because most people are tied to the R&D. And you, being a libertarian, have a much more awakened sense of that, and as an economist as well. So I'm going to go on to another question because we've just had a great conversation and we're rounding out into the hour, and I haven't even asked like 10% of the questions I'm going to ask you. I had a lot of messages about things to ask you, and so I will.
Sure.
We talked about the history of the Federal Reserves. What would you think would be an alternative to the Fed?
Well, basically, before the Fed, remember the dollar was defined in 1792 as 1/20th of an ounce of gold. So you could take a $20 $20 paper note and go to the bank and get a $20 gold piece for it. And so once you have convertibility or backing, remember the dollar is the name of a unit weight of gold, just as the other currencies represented weights of gold or silver or whatever the case may be. Paper money is not money, it's just paper, it's a money substitute. And that's what I point out in the book, how we go from barter to gold-backed money to paper money to demand deposits, checking accounts, if you will. That those all have to be backed by gold in a free market system. And Murray Rothbard points this out wonderfully in the mystery, his book, The Mystery of Banking, and his other book, What Has Government Done to Our Money, which you can all read free on the Mises.org website. These are things that I learned 45 years ago, which rounded out my education about money, banking, and finance, which allowed me to become a finance professor and write this book on the Fed, because I think every generation sort of needs a primer on how to understand what's going on. So I take the reader through money and banking and what the Federal Reserve has done to give us the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble. So in a free market monetary system, you'd have gold coins circulating and you'd have claims to the gold in reserve. They would be paper money, like we had, where the note would say payable and lawful money. That's what it said on the notes, that way you can get take that paper money and get gold for it, a $20 gold piece or a $10 gold piece or a $5 gold piece, double eagle, and half eagle. That's the way a free market money system works. That's the way money works without a f central bank. That's what freedom is all about. That's what monetary freedom is all about. Not the system that we have today, which is basically for the bankers and for Wall Street to prop
So,
up
Murray, you've
all
been
the
a
financial
great
assets that are out there.
source of information, and we have not even gone anywhere close to my notes, but I kind of like that because I really appreciate your point of view, your perspective, and you rub shoulders with Rothbard, which is super cool. I'm kind of jealous of that.
He
Wait,
was
okay.
just an incredible human being. I
Before
mean, the fact that
I
he
go on
passed
to my
away at
last
age
question,
68
tell me
was
about Murray
was
Rothbard.
yeah.
Tell me about him as a human being.
Sure. Well, I wasn't that close to him. I mean, he lived in New
Right.
York City when I lived in New York City. Then I moved to New Jersey, and then he got an appointment that he should have gotten in New York City. He got an endowed chair at the UNLV in Las Vegas, University of Nevada at Las Vegas. And he had a great career there, wrote a lot of books and articles, needs to say. And he was
I
just
love that.
incredibly optimistic. I mean, his knowledge of any subject was just unbelievable. And he was just always had a smile on his face. I never saw him downbeat at conferences. And he just was a great raconteur, storyteller. And but what impressed me so much about him is that he just knew so much about everything. I mean, it's just he was a walking encyclopedia, which in his apartment in New York City was lined with probably 10,000 books. I mean, everywhere he went, there were bookshelves, and he just read everything. And he made a living by doing book reviews in the 1950s before he got a teaching position. So he's probably the most well-read individual I ever met. Plus, he was incredibly productive. I mean, he would type.
Damn.
He could write a book in a week. That's how productive he was. I mean, he was just incredible. I mean, he wrote something for me back in the 1970s at a conference that I helped organize about inflation in the 1970s, and he wrote an essay that was, I think, 20, 30 pages long, and I don't know, in a day or two. So, with footnotes and everything. So he was just a prolific individual, a wonderful human being, and it's unfortunate that he passed away at such an early age, 1995, when he could have had at least two more decades of productivity, and who knows what his influence would have been. It's great today because of the Mises.org website. All his work is available through there for free, which is why the internet is such
I
an
agree.
incredible tool for liberating the human minds so they can read material that otherwise was not available. If
I
you look
love
at the
it.
back, here's my
Marie, I
all
love
my
it.
books back here. I must have about 1,000. I must have 1,000 books I picked up over the years, and this is what academics do: is they read so they can make cogent, coherent presentations about different topics. And in the fall, I expect to make a presentation at the college for a memorial lecture for one of our colleagues who hired me back in 1985 on America, the next 70 years, since it's the 70th anniversary of coming to America, go over the past 70 years and talk about what America could be like over the next 70 years. So I'm looking forward to making that presentation. Then, of course, going out
Yeah.
and talking about the Fed and having honest money, having money that reflects the ability of people to trade and not have their currency devalued and not have these cycles anymore, because that's what's debilitating. I
Oh,
mean, there
for
are people
sure.
still haven't
Yeah.
recovered from the 2008 Great Recession. There are still communities that are been devastated as jobs have gone overseas and factories have closed. So if we had a sounder economy, I think we'd have a lot more manufacturing in the United States, which would be great because those are pretty decent paying jobs. Instead, our monetary policy, as I pointed out earlier, have
For
helped
sure.
drive businesses overseas because of higher costs here. So they go to the low cost producers
Well,
overseas and
I would
in
interject
South
that
America and
most
Mexico and other places
Americans,
like that.
because they choose the R or the D, they don't understand free market economics. And so I'm really grateful for your book. We have gone long, but it's been really, really fun. And
Well, thank you.
you're a treasure. I'm actually really, I feel very, grateful to have interviewed you because I think you're just a wonderful economist in our age, and there's a lack of economic understanding in this generation. And I'm a newer libertarian. I've only been an anarchist as of the last couple of years, and then a big L libertarian before that. So I'm a big fan of Austrian economics, having been a former neocon. So I'm going to ask you just a couple quick fire questions because we have to round out for the video.
Sure.
We did that. We did that. Your book, so which has a really cool title. Plug your book. I like it.
Well, why the Federal Reserve sucks. I could have said
No, it sucks.
why the Federal
No, it
Reserve is
sucks.
counterproductive, which would have been nice. It really does. I mean, when all it means is a colloquial term saying it's bad. That's and so. Someone from a digital marketing person a couple of years ago, when I was finishing writing the book, said, "You need an edgy title." So we came up with this edgy title because, you need, as they say, the squeaky wheel gets noticed. And so hopefully people will not be turned off in the mainstream media. But this is why social media is so important. That's why if this book becomes well established, not only through the libertarian community, the Austrian economic community, but mainstream people who want a primer. I
That's
mean, this book is
important.
easy to
Yeah,
read. It
that's
really
very
is. I wrote
important.
it specifically so you don't, so you don't need a technical background in money and banking. And I think since my wife, who read the book when we were going through the proofs, she caught a few changes that we made, and she liked it. And she's not an economics person. She was a bio teacher and a an administrator in the New York City school system, and she said she really liked it because it explains things very easily for the average person. So I'm hoping that people buy a copy, buy one for their neighbor, their friend, their best friend, colleague, and we get a snowball effect. And this is how books get noticed by the media when it goes higher on the Amazon rankings. And if lightning should strike and it goes on the New York Times bestseller list, and I can get on some of the major cable shows, that would be the key, whether it's on Fox or MSNBC or CNN, and just challenge, have a discussion, have a civil discussion without any name calling or finger pointing, saying, listen, here's what the Fed has done, and here's how it does it. And why should we try something different? Because if we tried something different, maybe we would have better outcomes instead of this
I
roller
think that
coaster
you
economy.
spoke that more eloquently than I could ever. So I will end our chat because Facebook has a certain algorithm. So I'm going to end it about an hour 20. What I would say is to follow Maru Sabrin. I'm going to link the show notes when we go up on We Are Libertarians. As I said in the beginning, Ginger Arkey is on We Are Libertarians. It's a wonderful network. Obviously, you can still follow me here on just my social media, but I will link his the show notes and his book about why the Fed sucks, which it totally sucks ass. And then I'll link some of his social media pages. But I have really had a great discussion with you, Marie, and I really appreciate you. And so I hope your new venture into speaking to people and kind of reviving that whole 2008, 2012 campaign about why the Fed sucks, which has been lost amongst most people. I hope you can bring that back. I'm very excited about that. You're brilliant and. To report a problem. So we'll edit that out. But, anyways, I appreciate that's the part of my show notes. But I really appreciate you. And so go ahead and link what you want people to go to.
Well, if you go to my blog, murraysabrin.com, you can see the front cover, the back cover, which has a wonderful endorsement by Ron Paul, and then the link to the Amazon where you can purchase the book. And I really hope that, not for me personally, because this book is really was a labor of love. I wrote it on sabbatical 2 years ago, and the
Is it that
college
old?
gave me the opportunity to write this book. And so, well, it was written specifically as a
Okay.
financial history of the dot-com and housing bubble, and what the Fed was doing or not doing and saying at the time. So the goal was to point out who was right and who was wrong. And there are a lot of people who were wrong about what was going on during both bubbles because they don't focus on the key component of bubbles, which is money printing by the Federal Reserve. And so I point this out, and then there's a postscript which I wrote earlier this year about Chairman Powell, whether he's going to cave in to
Guy,
Donald
whatever about
Trump's
that guy.
call for lower interest rates. And next week we will sit. Well, here's the point. Everyone thinks that the Federal Reserve is going to lower interest rates, which would be
Sure.
unprecedented, that they lower interest rates with the stock market at an all-time high and unemployment at one of the lowest levels in
Unlikely.
history. This would be unprecedented, which from my perspective, I think the Fed is not going to lower rates because everyone's expecting it. And if they do lower rates, then the notion that the Fed is independent, which is what Chairman Powell says constantly, we are independent. If they lower rates, then it would deny the notion that they're independent because they're basically doing what Trump wants them to do. So the Fed is between the rock and a hard place. And so I think if they want to exert their independence, they won't lower rates. They'll keep rates at the same level and say, we're just going to wait and see exactly how the
How
economy
do we
unfolds
abolish
before
them?
we do anything. So, well, this is why it's going to take a lot of education and grassroots efforts like you're doing with the podcast. If we could reach several million people with the concept that the Fed is not our friend, the Fed does not give us good outcomes. It gives us these bubbles, and it's great when the bubbles are expanding because people's incomes go up, their asset values go up. Especially housing and artwork and things like that. But most people don't own these very expensive items. Most people in America have very little assets. In fact, what there's a statistic out there that a substantial number of Americans don't have $400 for an emergency repair for their car. I mean, people are really hurting out there. But if you live in New York City, a metropolitan area like I do, in New Jersey, or in San Francisco or Boston, the metropolitan areas where there's a lot of wealth concentrated. But if you live in rural and a flyover country, people are just scraping by from day to day, week to week, month to month. So they don't have much assets, they don't have much income. And so, as I've been saying for decades, what we need to do is develop a culture of financial independence. And with the federal government spending $4.4 trillion and states spending another trillion plus dollars or more, the government is really sucking up resources that can be better used by people and in their communities to develop the institutions and the organizations from a free market, nonprofit perspective that would give us better outcomes in terms of jobs and healthcare. That's basic and education. That's really the theme of my writing going forward, which I'll have a lot to do because I'll be th my, this coming year is my last year as a professor. After 35 years, I think it's time to hang up the shingle, so to speak, and go out there and try to do as much as I can to educate people outside the classroom and have a greater presence on social media and just go out there and speak to people all over the country if possible and point out that all is not right with America and here are the reasons why. And we need free markets because free markets are an extension of ourselves. And that's what I think we have to tie in. Free markets are what people are all about. Just as our arms and legs are part of us, free markets are part of our social structure
I
that
would quite
makes
agree,
life worth
and
living.
I've so much, even though we had a glitch earlier, it's fine because we do this live, and most people aren't brave enough to do what I do live. But we had a great discussion about like market principles and economics, and some people might find that boring, but actually I think this is a really interesting discussion. And so I really appreciate you coming on and explaining things in layman's terms. That's really important. So I would encourage you to go to Murray's Facebook site or his website. Can you drop those credentials right now?
The website is murraysavern.com,
Yes.
and guess what? Here's a copy of the book. And you can see this on my website, the front and back cover. Here's the back cover with Ron Paul's endorsement. Of course, it's small print. I can bring it closer, and a little bio about me. But if you go to my website, we have all the good stuff. I don't do a lot of original writing now because I'm working on this other book on healthcare. But I'm posting articles that I think are important that people should read so they could just find two, three articles a day that I think explain what's going on overseas, what's going on domestically. And this way people get an idea that there's a better way of doing things. I like to put things in positive terms. How can we have better outcomes for the economy, for healthcare, for international relations, as opposed to just bashing people and who they are. I just want to talk about how we can achieve a better society, how we can, that's what libertarianism is all about, is how to achieve a better society with with no wars, with no
I think
strife,
that's
social
a
strife,
wonderful
with
position. So many people fight
full
against what's
employment.
happening now, and they don't provide any resource as to how it can be better. And I think you're doing that with your book. We can just be better, people. It's okay.
Well,
I am a part of it,
there's a great
actually.
organization called We Do Better, and they're propose, yeah, that to me, that's what I'm going to propose in my book on healthcare, is that if we have universal tax credits, that will help fund the nonprofits
That's what we
to
do.
provide
I'm
healthcare
a
for
member, I
low-income
donate,
folks,
and
and
I'm
we can,
probably going to do some media for
and
them.
that's.
And that's what you do. Do stuff on any level you can. Like, don't be the asshole that sits and criticizes things. Like, maybe do something.
Well, that's it. I was invited by the founder of a nonprofit health center in Bergen County 15 years ago, And this fall, they're having their 10th anniversary. It took 5 years to get the place going, but they do a great job in saving lives in Bergen County, which is a fairly wealthy community. But there are people who still don't have much means. And so we have a great nonprofit right here in Hackensack, the county seat, and they do a great job in saving people's lives and getting them back to better health. So it's a matter of personal responsibility. It's community responsibility. It's the institutions we need have to be at the local level, as opposed to top down, the trickle down, I call it the trickle down economics from Washington, the Medicare, the Medicaid, the Social Security, all these programs out of Washington, the
We
Department of
need to
Education, Department of Energy. We
decentralize.
don't need these institutions, organizations. Absolutely. It's about individuals, family, community. That is what the structure of a free society, of a prosperous society would be all about,
And
instead
with
of this
that, I want to
welfare
close.
warfare state that we have.
Thank you so much for coming on, Marie. You're a source of great wisdom and information. I've enjoyed it. And maybe I have a broad spectrum of listeners. So I would say to you all what I say at the close of everything. But maybe Murray is a little bit more of a minarchist than I am, but he's a brilliant man and he has a lot of things to say that could probably lead to more for free society than us sitting around and bitching who's a minarchist and who's an anarchist. And so I'm pragmatic in that idea. So I'm going to close this show saying thank you so much, Murray. I've really enjoyed it. And what I always say, grace and peace to you, my lovelies, and fuck the state.